But then one thinks of the great temples of Paestum, south of Naples, or of those at Segesta and Agrigento in Sicily, or beyond the Aegean of the immense Greek theater at Ephesus, of the smaller ones overlooking the sea at Side and Ka, or of the almost unbearably evocative ruins of Priene, one of the relatively few Greek cities of the coast to have escaped Romanization, with its lovely little Bouletarion, where the chosen representatives of the people would meet under the sky and conduct the business of the city. All this may not be Greece as we think of the country today, but it is the Greek world which is far more important. There were also a number of petty kingdoms in Asia Minor, which, though increasingly influenced by Greek culture until they were almost completely Hellenized, had their origins in those far-off days before the Greeks were ever heard of. Pergamum, for example, whose shrine to Aesculapius, the god of healing, had made it a place of pilgrimage for many centuries before it acquired something approaching political supremacy in the 2nd and 1st centuries BC, or Phrygia, whose celebrated King Midas, he of the fabled Golden Touch, reigned in the 8th century BC. Or Lydia, ruled in the 6th century BC by the still richer King Croesus, where coinage and gambling were both invented, perhaps simultaneously, and of whose inhabitants Herodotus was to write, "Except for the fact that they prostitute their daughters, the manners of the Lydians are much like our own." This lack of political unity was entirely beneficial to the development of Greek art, culture, and thought. It encouraged diversity and gave rise to a good deal of healthy competition. But it proved a serious weakness in the face of a formidable imperial power which, through most of the 6th century BC, was steadily increasing in strength. The Persian Empire was essentially the creation of Cyrus the Great, who, during his 30-year reign from 559 to 529 BC, welded a number of disparate tribes into a single nation and made that nation the mightiest on earth. The Persians were superb soldiers and magnificent bowmen who would again and again overwhelm their enemies under hails of arrows. Thanks to them and to his equally fine cavalry, Cyrus defeated Croesus in 546 BC, subsequently extending his authority along the Anatolian coast to Caria and Lycia. At a stroke, Persia had become a Mediterranean power. Under Darius the Great, who came to the throne in 522 BC having murdered Cyrus's son, Cambyses, it very nearly became a European one. Darius launched his first major expedition against the Greeks in 490 BC, when he sent a huge fleet and at least 15,000 men under his nephew, Datis, across the Aegean in an all-out assault on Athens. The Greek general, Miltiades, quickly rallied some 10,000 Athenian citizen soldiers and another 1,000 from the little town of Plataea, ranging them in a long line across the plain of Marathon, some 22 miles from the city. A reluctant Spartan army failed to turn up in time, and Miltiades did not wait for it. The battle was over quite quickly. The strongly reinforced Greek wings penetrated their Persian opposites and then wheeled inwards to envelop the center. Datis's army turned and fled with the Greeks in hot pursuit. Persian losses amounted to 6,400. The Athenians lost 192 and captured 5 Persian ships into the bargain. Athens had won a battle, but she had not won the war. All she had gained was breathing space in which to prepare for the next onslaught. Her leader, Themistocles, who had been elected archon, titular head of state, in 493 BC, was convinced that her best hope lay in sea power and set about building a navy. By an extraordinary stroke of good luck, a rich new vein of silver had just been discovered in the mines at nearby Laurium, so finance was not a serious problem. Fortunately, too, the Persians were heavily engaged in putting down a rebellion in Egypt, and the death of Darius in 486 BC delayed them still further. Finally, however, in the spring of 481 BC, a new expedition of 100,000 men under Darius's son and successor, Xerxes, crossed the Hellespont, Dardanelles, on a bridge of boats and marched through Thrace into Thessaly. It was said to be so huge a horde that the men and pack animals together drank the rivers dry. The anxious Athenians consulted the oracle at Delphi and were told to put their faith in their wooden walls. But as nobody knew whether this was meant to refer to the fortifications of the Acropolis or the new ships, it did not help much. At any rate, they ignored the advice and, accompanied this time by a fair-sized contingent from Sparta, under the Spartan king Leonidas, marched north to meet the army. They decided to make their stand at the pass of Thermopylae, the gateway to Boeotia and Attica. The Spartans and Athenians fought valiantly side by side for 3 days. But then a local guide showed Xerxes a narrow path through the mountains by which he could fall upon the Spartans from behind. While the main body of Greeks retired to the south, Leonidas and 300 picked troops fought a desperate rearguard action and were killed to the last man. Now the way to Athens lay open. Themistocles evacuated the city and established a new headquarters on the neighboring island of Salamis, summoning all his available ships. They amounted, we are told, to 378 vessels to assemble in the Saronic Gulf. They did so only to find themselves almost immediately bottled up by the Persian fleet of nearly 600. But then, instead of trying to burst through the blockade, they craftily withdrew into the narrow waters behind Salamis, luring the Persians in after them. Fighting at close quarters, the Greek triremes proved far nimbler and more maneuverable than the heavy Persian war galleys, which they rammed mercilessly, while the increasingly furious Xerxes, seated on a silver-footed throne under a golden umbrella, watched the progress of the engagement from the Attic shore. By the time the battle was over, the Greeks had sunk almost half his ships, at a cost of 40 of their own. He returned to his capital at Susa and never set foot in Greece again. In Thessaly, he left an army of some 30,000 men under a general named Mardonius, which was defeated at the Battle of Plataea the following year. And traditionally, on the same day, a last naval engagement off Cape Mycale in Asia Minor did for the few Persian ships remaining. The war was won. Inevitably, the outcome of the Persian War was seen as a victory of Western liberty over Eastern autocracy and absolutism. The great king, with all his huge and lumbering war machine, had been unable to destroy a mere handful of Greek city-states. But why, it may be asked, only a handful? Athens and Plataea, Sparta, and the few other cities that made up the Spartan-led Peloponnesian League had distinguished themselves nobly. What about the rest? The truth is that the vast majority of Greek states had not lifted a finger. Some, doubtless, had collaborated with the Persians out of fear. Others had simply accepted life under a probably tolerant and undemanding satrap with a shrug. After all, the great cities of the Ionian coast, Pergamum and Ephesus, Miletus and Priene, had lived under the banner of the great king for the past 40 years without complaint. Finally, there were many upper-class, conservative Greeks all over the Aegean, who shuddered at the radical steps towards popular democracy that had been taken over the past century, above all in Athens, by reformers like Solon and Cleisthenes, and frankly preferred the Ancien Régime. Having no real nationality themselves, they saw no objection to a mildly benevolent foreign domination. Halicarnassus, the modern Bodrum, was also under Persian domination when Herodotus was born there in 484 BC. At the age of about 20, however, he opposed the tyranny of the Persian satrap Ligdamus and narrowly escaped a death sentence. Expelled from the empire, he settled in Samos, which was to remain his principal base until, in 444 BC, he was involved in the Athenian colonization of Thori in southern Italy. Throughout his life, he seems to have been constantly on the move. He certainly spent some time in Athens, where he became a close friend of Sophocles, and traveled all over Greece and Asia Minor, the Lebanon, and Palestine. Other journeys took him to Cyrene in Libya, to Babylon in Mesopotamia, and up the Nile to Aswan in Upper Egypt. Wherever he went, he asked questions, not only about history, but about geography, mythology, social customs, and anything else that occurred to him. His history, the first important European literary work to be written in prose, was mostly composed towards the end of his life and was divided after his death into 9 books, each named after one of the muses. Although written nearly 2.5 millennia ago, it remains today quite astonishingly readable, enlivened as it is with countless digressions, anecdotes, and snatches of curious information picked up on the author's travels. The whole thing is infused with an irresistible sense of curiosity, of wonder, of sheer fascination with the beauty and diversity of the world around him. Herodotus is thus thoroughly, magnificently Greek. He embodies the Greek spirit as completely as the great tragedians of the 5th century, or even as Homer himself. We have all been brought up to see the 5th century BC in Athens as a golden age, an age which not only saw an unprecedented advance in the arts and sciences, as well as in philosophy and political theory, but which in many cases attained in these same fields a level of perfection that has never since been surpassed. This, it need hardly be said, is a generalization. We can see the beginnings of the phenomenon almost 100 years earlier, and those responsible for it were by no means only Athenians. It was in Ionia that Thales of Miletus, who was considered by Aristotle to be the first natural philosopher, correctly predicted a solar eclipse as early as 585 BC, and that his colleague, Anaximander, produced the first map of the inhabited world. Half a century later, on the island of Samos, Pythagoras produced his famous theorem about right-angled triangles. But it was in Athens that Pisistratus began the Temple of Olympian Zeus in 540 BC, by which time the art of black figure pottery was at its height. And it was again in Athens that, after the end of the Persian War, all this creativity, versatility, and brilliance seemed to come together in a single concentration of genius, bringing with it a huge wave of confidence and optimism. Man, it seemed, had freed himself from the primitive superstitions of former times. At last he was beginning to understand the universe about him, and to understand it was surely to control it. Simultaneously, he was discovering the basic truths of political philosophy, which taught him how to live in the society into which he had been born. With such a combination of power and knowledge, he would not simply enjoy his golden age, he would make it go on forever. The presiding spirit over all this was Pericles. He dominated Athens from 461 BC, when he was 34, until his death in 429 BC of plague, and everything he did or said was inspired by a passionate love for his native city. He did his best to adorn it in every way possible, by restoring the temples destroyed by the Persians and organizing the construction of new ones, particularly on the Acropolis, where he was directly responsible for the Propylaea, the Odeon, the Erechtheum, and the Parthenon itself. But he was also a war leader and an incorrigible imperialist, for it should never be assumed that the 5th century in Athens was a time of peace. On the contrary, there was almost constant fighting with Sparta, as also with many other Greek states who resented and resisted Athenian expansionist policies. The pressures steadily building up until 431 BC, they exploded in the Peloponnesian War. That war, one of the chief reasons for which was the determination of each side to control the trade routes linking Greece to the Adriatic, lasted for just over a quarter of the glorious 5th century. Anyone wanting to know the full story can read Thucydides. Here it need only be said that it ended with a winter-long siege of Athens, 405 to 04 BC, during which the city was starved into surrender. So much, it might be thought, for the Golden Age. But the Golden Age was never about politics. It was about art and thought. In the field of literature, and in particular that of Greece's greatest strength, the drama. The first great name was that of Aeschylus. Having been born in 525 BC, he had certainly fought at Marathon, and probably also at Salamis and Plataea. During his long life, he wrote over 80 plays, of which 7 have survived, including the only extant Greek trilogy, the Orestia. Aeschylus was in many ways a pioneer. His tragedies were the first to explore human personality, and the first also to use a second actor, thus reducing to some degree the importance of the chorus. He made 2 prolonged visits to Sicily, at that time still an integral part of the Greek world, and it was there, in 456 BC, that he died, killed, according to a venerable tradition, by an eagle which mistook his bald head for a rock and dropped a tortoise onto it in order to crack the shell. Sophocles, some 30 years younger than Aeschylus, was still more prolific, with 123 plays to his credit. Once again, 7 tragedies have come down to us, including 3 which deal with the Oedipus legend. Apart from these, Oedipus Rex, Antigone, and Oedipus at Colonus, his masterpiece is unquestionably Electra, which tells the story of the murder by Electra and her brother, Orestes, of their mother, Clytemnestra, wife of Agamemnon, and her lover, Aegestus. Sophocles, too, was an innovator. Aristotle tells us that he added a 3rd actor, and he also introduced the art of scene painting. On top of all this, he somehow found the time to distinguish himself in Athenian public life. Treasurer of the Delian League, he served 2 on the military council of 10 generals. He was also a priest of Helen, another lesser god of healing. He died in 406 BC at the age of 90. Sometime before his death, his sons took him to court on the grounds that he had grown senile and was no longer competent to manage his affairs. He replied by reciting from memory a long extract from his most recent play, Oedipus at Colonus, and won his case. 3rd and last of the great tragedians was Euripides. Born in 484 BC, he was 12 years younger than Sophocles and died a few months before him in 406 BC. At the festival of Dionysus in that year, Sophocles dressed the chorus and actors in black in his memory. In a later age, Euripides would have been hailed as a Renaissance man. As well as a playwright, he was a fine painter and a skilled musician. His library was one of the best in Athens. He is believed to have written 92 plays, 19 of which have survived. They include Andromache, Hippolytus, Medea, and the Trojan Woman. The same old myths used by his predecessors, but usually given an unexpected, often contemporary twist. The only other dramatist of the day who deserves to be mentioned in the same breath as these 3 was a writer not of tragedies, but of comedies, and highly satirical ones at that. Aristophanes, who was born around 445 BC, was a generation younger than Euripides, and, as might be expected, still more down to earth. He wrote some 54 plays, of which we have 11 in their entirety. In them, he mercilessly caricatured the leading figures of Athenian political, cultural, and social life, including Socrates in The Clouds, Cleon in The Nights, and Lamarcus, one of the leading Athenian generals during the Peloponnesian War, in The Acharnians. In The Frogs, Dionysus, god of the theater, goes down to Hades to fetch back Euripides, but after a mock trial scene brings back Aeschylus instead. Most famous of all, perhaps, is Lysistrata, in which the women of the Greek cities withhold their favors from their husbands until peace is restored. Of the great Athenian philosophers, only Socrates, who lived from 469 to 399 BC, properly belongs to the 5th century. He wrote nothing, simply because he claimed to know nothing, nor, he believed, did anybody else, and so he did not feel justified in teaching. Instead, he discussed anything and everything, good, evil, truth, justice, virtue, religion. The last subject proved to be his downfall. In the early spring of 399 BC, he was accused of impiety, having, it was said, introduced strange new gods whom the state did not recognize. Moreover, though he had a wife, Xantippe, and two sons, he was also accused of having habitually seduced young men. These two charges together were enough to have him found guilty by a jury of 501 citizens and sentenced to death. His friends offered to bribe the prison authorities to let him escape. He refused on moral grounds. A month later, he publicly drained a cup of hemlock and died. Plato, who was to immortalize him, was 28 when he attended the trial of Socrates and was deeply shaken by his death, after which he spent some years traveling in Egypt, Italy, and Sicily. Unlike his friend, he wrote copiously, often expounding his philosophical theories in the form of dramatic dialogues, in which Socrates plays a prominent part. He himself remains in the background and, though he argues with consummate brilliance, never quite commits himself to any particular doctrine of his own. Sometime in the 380s BC, he founded a school just outside Athens, in a grove sacred to the hero Academus. It consequently became known as the Academy, a word later adopted by nearly all the languages of Europe. Plato's star pupil, whom he described as the mind of the school, was a young Ionian Greek from Thrace by the name of Aristotle. Born at Stagira near Thessalonica in 384 BC, Aristotle remained at the Academy until Plato's death in 347 BC. when he settled at Assos in Asia Minor and opened a school. In 342 BC, he received an invitation from Philip II of Macedon to be private tutor to the king's 14-year-old son, Alexander, a post he held for 2 years. His charge then became regent for Philip, at which point Aristotle returned to Athens to found another school of his own, this time in a grove sacred to Apollo Lykios, which earned it the name Lyceum. Aristotle was more than a philosopher. His surviving oeuvre also contains works on ethics, history, science, politics, literary and dramatic criticism, nature, meteorology, dreams, and a particular interest of his, zoology. He was, in short, a polymath, perhaps the first in history. And he left behind him the first true library, a vast collection of manuscripts and maps, which was the prototype for Pergamum, Alexandria, and all the other great public libraries of antiquity. For some years after the end of the Peloponnesian War, Sparta ruled the Greek roost, but early in the next century, the spotlight shifted to a place both unexpected and unfamiliar. In those days of antiquity, Macedonia must have seemed rather like Scotland appeared to medieval Englishmen, a land of wild and uncouth barbarians, divided into endlessly warring clans. Their almost total lack of culture and politesse, rivaled only by a prodigious capacity for alcohol. All this was certainly true of the Macedonian highlands, but the lowlands included the city of Pella, from which, for a century already, a dynasty known as the Argeids had held sway, at least in theory, over the entire country. For our purposes, the story begins with King Philip II, who succeeded to the throne on the death of his brother in 359 BC. The country he inherited was poor and disorganized. He immediately established a professional army, which he subjected to intensive training and kept mobilized not just in summer, as was the usual practice, but all the year round. In 20 years, he made Macedonia the most powerful state in Eastern Europe, dramatically upsetting the balance of power throughout the Greek world. In 338 BC, he led his army southward, forcing the city-states of southern Greece, led by Athens and Thebes, to make a hasty alliance. They dispatched an army to meet him, and the opposing forces met on 4 August at Chaeronea in Boeotia. The result was a resounding victory for Philip. To this day, by the roadside just to the east of the modern village, a stone lion marks the common tomb of the Theban Sacred Band, a body 300 strong, which was traditionally composed of 150 pairs of male lovers. 254 skeletons have been found nearby. Among the ambassadors sent by Philip to Athens to offer terms for a settlement was his son Alexander. Though still only 18, the young prince had fought with distinction at Chaeronea, leading the cavalry on the left wing. From childhood, he had been brought up as his father's eventual successor. His tutor, Aristotle, one of the most reactionary intellectuals that ever lived, had given him a strong sense of his divine right to rule, and gone so far as to advise him to be a leader to the Greeks and a despot to the barbarians, to look after the former as after friends and relatives, and to deal with the latter as with beasts or plants. The boy was consumed with ambition, and so impatient to assume the reins of kingship that Philip soon began to suspect a conspiracy against him. He may well have been right. In 336 BC, in the course of festivities to celebrate the alarmingly incestuous marriage of his wife's brother with her own daughter, the king was assassinated by a member of his own bodyguard. Was Alexander implicated in the murder? Nothing was ever proved, but what evidence there is points fairly convincingly to him and to his mother, Olympias, whom Philip had recently divorced. It certainly came at a providential moment. With the unanimous consent of the army, Alexander at once assumed his father's command. Then, pausing only to institute a swift campaign against Thebes, of which he left not one stone standing on another, in the spring of 334 BC, he crossed the Hellespont and started off on the great expedition that was to occupy the remainder of his short but astonishing life, an expedition launched with the dual purpose of freeing the Greek cities of Asia Minor from Persian domination and then forging a great empire of his own in eastern lands. While still on Mediterranean territory, he won two historic battles over the Persian king Darius III. The first on the river Granicus, now the Cancale, about 30 miles east of Troy. The second in the following year on the plain of Issus, between Alexandretta and Antioch, now Iskedron and Antakya, respectively. After this, there was little opposition, as he led his army south along the coast of Palestine and across the north of the Sinai Peninsula into Egypt, where he spent the winter of 332 to 31 BC. With the coming of spring, he struck east again, first to Tyre, and then over the mountains to Damascus, and so he passes out of our story. Alexander died in Babylon on 13 June 323 BC, aged 32, leaving chaos behind him. His only surviving son, Heracles, was a bastard. His wife, Roxanne, was pregnant at the time of his death. But the baby might well have proved to be a girl, and nobody was prepared to wait another 6 weeks to see. Fierce infighting broke out among his generals and the noble Macedonians who formed his court. This soon spread to the Mediterranean, and before long the entire Greek world was being torn apart by ambition and avarice. It was, in its way, inevitable. Alexander's empire could never have lasted. It was too large, too unwieldy, too quickly conquered. A victim of his own ambition, the young adventurer had thought only of advance, never of consolidation. And the almost random fragmentation of the empire after his death made its further dissolution inevitable. Infinitely more important than Alexander's short-lived empire was the cultural legacy that he left behind him, the eastward extension of Greek culture as far as Afghanistan and the Indus Valley, and its fusion with that of Persia. Both fall outside the scope of this audiobook. But the Hellenistic period also had a huge impact throughout the eastern Mediterranean. There, as elsewhere, Greek-style cities sprang up, with temples and agoras, theaters and gymnasia. But the vast majority were no longer independent city-states as they had been in the past. They were now part of a larger polity, richer and stronger, able to launch programs of shipbuilding on a scale which would have been unthinkable in previous centuries. Moreover, they were eventually to provide a fertile field for the spread of a new religion, which was to develop out of Judaism while professing none of the latter's exclusiveness, Christianity as preached and developed by St. Paul. When at last the smoke from Alexander's dying empire cleared away, and it was to take the best part of 20 years, three major powers emerged from the ashes. One was the old kingdom of Macedonia, no longer master of Western Asia, but still dominating northern Greece and a considerable force throughout the Greek world. The second was the empire built up by Alexander's general, Seleucus, formerly leader of the Shield-Bearers, his own personal guard of honor, who, beginning in Babylonia, soon imposed his authority over Mesopotamia and Syria until his domains extended from his capital at Antioch to the eastern end of the Persian Gulf. The line of Seleucid kings that he established was to continue for nearly four centuries, until it was eventually wiped out by Rome in 72 AD. The third power was Egypt, where in 305 BC, Alexander's oldest friend, a soldier historian named Ptolemy, proclaimed himself king. He proved a remarkable success, ruling from Alexander's new foundation of Alexandria, home of the greatest library in the ancient world, a city in which the large Jewish community would regularly read the Torah, not in Hebrew but in Greek, and from another city which he himself founded called Ptolemais in Upper Egypt. This bluff Macedonian assumed the character, as well as the power, of the ancient pharaohs, and during a 40-year reign extended his dominions to Palestine and southern Syria, Cyprus, Asia Minor, and the Cyclades. He also engendered a line of no less than 15 rulers of Egypt, a remarkable number for a single dynasty. But more remarkable still by reason of the fact that almost every one of them married his own sister, half-sister, or niece. It was Ptolemy XIV, coming to the throne in 47 BC, who took as his bride his 21-year-old sister, Cleopatra. Greek, the Ptolemies may have been. The world they lived in, however, at least where later generations were concerned, was Roman. The time has now come to retrace our steps a century or two and to inquire how it was that a small and inconsequential Italian town made itself, in a remarkably short space of time, master of the civilized world. Chapter 3. Rome, the Republic. The rise of Rome was due, more than anything else, to the character and qualities of the Romans themselves. They were a simple, straightforward, law-abiding people with a strong sense of family values, willing to accept discipline when required to do so, as they certainly had been in 510 BC when they expelled the Tarquins, that line of Etruscan kings who had ruled them for the previous century, and established a republic of their own. Their city, they claimed, predated the Etruscans by many centuries. It had originally been founded by the Trojan prince, Aeneas, who had made his way to Italy after the Greeks' destruction of his city. Rome was thus the successor to ancient Troy. In 280 BC, an ambitious ruler of a Hellenistic state in northwestern Greece, King Pyrrhus of Epirus, landed with an army estimated at 20,000 at Tarentum, the modern Taranto. The Roman army met him near Herculia, where it was narrowly beaten, Pyrrhus' losses being almost as great as the Romans. Thus the concept of a Pyrrhic victory was born. For the next 5 years, the king continued to make trouble, but with less and less success. Finally, in 275 BC, having lost some two-thirds of his army, he returned to Epirus. Rome, a still obscure republic in central Italy, had defeated a Hellenistic king. The subsequent triumphal procession in the capital featured Pyrrhus's captured elephants, the first to make their appearance in Italy. But Rome's greatest enemy was Carthage, originally a colony of the Phoenicians which occupied part of the site of the modern city of Tunis. Carthaginians were a thorn in the Roman flesh for well over 100 years, from 264 to 146 BC, during which the Romans were obliged to fight two separate Punic wars before they were able to eliminate it forever. It was these two wars that brought Rome to the center of the Mediterranean stage, and since it soon became clear that Carthage could never be defeated on land alone, made her a leading sea power. The first, which ended in 241 BC, had one extremely happy result for Rome, the acquisition of the greater part of Sicily, which would henceforth constitute her principal granary. Corsica and Sardinia were to follow 3 years later. She had greater cause for concern, however, during the 23-year interval that elapsed before the beginning of the second, because during that period, Carthage succeeded in establishing a whole new empire, this time in Spain. The Phoenicians had first reached the Iberian Peninsula around 1100 BC, when they founded the port of Cadiz. It was in those days an island, and it set the pattern for subsequent Phoenician colonies, all of which tended to be positioned on promontories or offshore islands, often at a river mouth. Presumably, since, like all merchants, they were a peaceful lot, in order not to encroach more than necessary on the natives. Of these last, the most advanced were the Iberians, a mysterious people whose two languages are, like the Etruscan, not Indo-European, and unlike the Etruscan, continue to baffle us. The Iberians traded enthusiastically with the Phoenicians, with whom they seem to have existed on friendly terms. Some centuries later, they were to develop a remarkable civilization of their own, notable above all for its statuary. The so-called Dama de Elche, dating from the 4th century BC, and now in the Archaeological Museum in Madrid, is one of the most beautiful and most haunting ancient sculptures to be seen anywhere. In about 237 BC, Hamilcar Barca, Carthage's most distinguished general or admiral, since he seems to have been equally at home on land and at sea, set off for the Iberian Peninsula, taking with him his little son, Hannibal, aged 9. Here, over the space of just 8 years, he built up all the infrastructure of a prosperous state with a sizable army to defend it. Accidentally drowned in 229 BC, he was succeeded by his son-in-law, Hasdrubal, who established the permanent capital of Carthaginian Spain at what the Romans called New Carthage, and we call Cartagena. He also did much to develop the art of mining. A single mine, Babylo, was said to produce 300 pounds of silver a day. When Hasdrubal was assassinated by an Iberian slave in 221 BC, his place was taken by Hannibal, now 26. Hannibal was to prove the greatest military leader the world had seen since Alexander. Indeed, he may well have been one of the greatest of all time. According to tradition, his father had made him swear eternal hatred of Rome. He was determined from the moment of his accession to avenge his country's defeat of 20 years before, and confident that the new Spanish dominion, with all its vast resources of wealth and manpower, would enable him to do so. He left Spain in the spring of 218 BC with an army of some 40,000 men, taking the land route along the south coast of France, up the Rhone Valley, then east to Briançon, and the pass at Montgenèvre. His infantry was mostly Spanish, though officered by Carthaginians, his cavalry drawn from Spain and North Africa. It included 37 elephants. His famous crossing of the Alps took place in the early autumn and was followed by two victorious battles in quick succession. By the end of the year, he controlled virtually the whole of northern Italy. But then the momentum began to fail. He had counted on a general rising of the Italian cities, uneasy as they were at the growing power of Rome, but he was disappointed. Even a third victory in April 217 BC, when he trapped the Roman army in a defile between Lake Trasimene and the surrounding hills, proved ultimately ineffective. It was no use his marching on Rome. The city possessed formidable defensive walls, and he had no siege engines worth speaking of. He therefore swung around to Apulia and Calabria, where the largely Greek populations had no love for the Romans and might well, he thought, defect to his side. Once again, he was wrong. Instead of the sympathetic allies for which he had hoped, he soon found himself faced by yet another Roman army, far larger and better equipped than his own, which had followed him southward, and on 3 August 216 BC, at Cannae, beside the Ofanto River, some 10 miles southwest of the modern Barletta, battle was joined. The result was another victory for Hannibal, perhaps the greatest of his life, and for the Romans, the most devastating defeat in their history. Thanks to his superb generalship, the legionaries found themselves surrounded and were cut to pieces where they stood. By the end of the day, over 50,000 of them lay dead on the field. Hannibal's casualties amounted to just 5,700. Hannibal had now destroyed all Rome's fighting forces, apart from those kept within the capital for its defense. But he was no nearer his ultimate objective, the destruction of the Republic. His strongest weapon, that magnificent Spanish and North African cavalry, by now strictly equine since the elephants had all succumbed to the cold and damp, was powerless against the city walls. He was encouraged, on the other hand, by the hope that his brother, another Hasdrubal, might be raising a second army, this time with proper siege engines, and joining him as soon as it was ready. Then, to his surprise, he found in Campania, that province of Italy south of Rome of which Naples is the center, just that degree of popular support that seemed to be lacking elsewhere in the peninsula. Marching his army across the mountains to Capua, at that time Italy's second largest city, he established his headquarters there and settled down to wait. He waited a very long time, for Hasdrubal had problems of his own. The Romans, swift to take advantage of Hannibal's absence, had within months of his departure invaded Spain, with a force of 2 legions and some 15,000 allied troops, under a young general named Gnaeus Cornelius Scipio, who was soon joined by his brother, Publius. The immediate consequence of this invasion was a long struggle between Roman and Carthaginian forces, with the local Iberians fighting on both sides. The eventual result was a Roman presence in the peninsula which lasted over 6 centuries. After the death of the two Scipios in 211 BC, they were replaced by a kinsman, also called Publius, who took Cartagena after a short siege. With the capture of their capital, the Carthaginians swiftly lost heart, and by 206 BC, the last of them had left the peninsula. While there had been hope of victory over the Romans in Spain, Hasdrubal had had no chance of organizing a relief expedition to help his brother. Not until 206 BC, when he knew he was beaten, could he begin to consider such an enterprise. And when in 205 he in turn led his men across southern France and across the Alps, he was marching to disaster. On the Metaurus River, just outside Ancona, he encountered a Roman army and his force was cut to pieces. Hannibal learned the news only when his brother's severed head was delivered to his Capuan camp. He remained in Italy for another 4 years, but he would have been wiser to return. Elsewhere in the Mediterranean, young Publius Cornelius Scipio had by now taken the offensive. In 204 BC, Publius and his army landed on the North African coast at Utica, less than 20 miles west of Carthage, where they routed 20,000 local troops and established a position on the Bay of Tunis, threatening the city itself. In the spring of 203, Hannibal, now seriously alarmed, hurried back to Carthage, and in the following year led an army of 37,000 men and 80 elephants against the Roman invaders. The two sides eventually met near the village of Zama, where, after a long and hard-fought battle, Hannibal suffered the only major defeat of his extraordinary career. It was at Zama, we are told, that the Romans finally discovered how to deal with the Carthaginians' favorite tactical weapon, their elephants. First, a sudden blast of trumpets would terrify them to the point where their riders lost control. The Romans would then open their ranks, and the panic-stricken animals would charge between them, out of what they thought to be harm's way. The Roman victory was complete. The Second Punic War was over. Rome's prize for her victory was Spain. All the carefully built-up Carthaginian military and civil administration had already been dismantled. The Scipios had seen to that, and now it remained only for Carthage formally to cede the peninsula to her conquerors. Hannibal himself, who had narrowly escaped death at Zama, lived on until 183 BC, when he took poison to avoid being captured by the enemy he so hated. As for the victorious Scipio, he was rewarded with the title of Africanus, which he richly deserved. He more than any other of his compatriots had ensured that it was Rome, not Carthage, which would be mistress of the Mediterranean in the centuries that followed. But the Punic Wars had had a traumatic effect. They had brought the Roman Republic several times to the brink of disaster, and had in all claimed the lives of perhaps 200,000 or 300,000 of her men. And yet there, across the narrow sea, the city of Carthage still stood, its population of some 750,000 unharmed, industrious and enterprising, recovering from its recent defeat with almost frightening speed, to every patriotic Roman a reminder, a reproach, and a continuing threat. Clearly, its survival could not be tolerated. Delenda est Carthago. Carthage is to be deleted. These words were spoken by the elder Cato at the end of every speech he made in the Senate until they eventually became a watchword. The only question was how the job was to be done. At last, in 151 BC, an excuse was found when the Carthaginians presumed to defend their city from the depredations of a local chieftain. Rome treated this very natural reaction as a casus belli, and in 149 BC, once again, sent out an invading army. This time, the Carthaginians surrendered unconditionally until they heard the Roman peace terms, which were that their city should be utterly destroyed, and that its inhabitants should not be permitted to rebuild their homes anywhere within 10 miles of the sea. Appalled, they decided, after all, to resist. The result was a terrible 2-year siege, after which, in 146 BC, the threatened destruction took place, not one stone being left on another. Cato was obeyed. Carthage was deleted. The Kingdom of Pontus, a hitherto somewhat insignificant state lying along the southern shore of the Black Sea, should have no place in a history of the Mediterranean, nor would it have had but for its young king Mithridates VI, who for 25 years was the principal thorn in the flesh of the Roman Republic. Although by race he and his subjects were Persian, he always liked to think of himself as a Greek, a proud champion of Hellenism, who would inspire all the Greek cities to rise up against their Latin oppressors. In 88 BC, he invaded the Roman province of Asia and engineered a mass uprising which ended in a massacre of some 80,000 Italian residents. Then, emboldened by his success, he crossed the Aegean and occupied Athens. Several other Greek cities fell to him in their turn. Clearly, Rome had to act, and the Roman Senate chose as supreme commander of its expeditionary force a 50-year-old patrician by the name of Lucius Cornelius Sulla, possessed of a fine military record and a first-hand knowledge of Asia. Just as he was about to embark, however, the Democratic faction in the Senate successfully moved that he be replaced by an old and somewhat decayed general under whom he had once served, Gaius Marius. It was a disastrous decision, and Sulla categorically refused to accept it. With his army behind him to a man, he marched on Rome, liquidated his enemies, and, without more ado, set off for Greece. He stormed Athens, destroyed its port of Piraeus, won 2 decisive victories in the field, and eventually concluded a peace treaty with Mithridates, though on what to many seemed surprisingly easy terms. All this, however, he had achieved without any semblance of authority from the government of Rome, where, in his absence, the Marian party had returned to power. Hastening back to the capital, Sulla routed them for the second time and assumed the role of dictator, unhesitatingly ordering the mass murder of nearly 10,000 of his political enemies, including 40 senators and some 1,600 equites or knights. He then passed a series of highly reactionary laws which had the effect of putting back the clock by at least half a century. Finally, with his work successfully completed, he abdicated and returned to his home in Campania. Here he led an extremely dissolute life, terrorizing his many slaves. From time to time, pour encourager les autres, perhaps he would sentence one or two of them to death, usually taking care to be present when the sentence was carried out. But one day in 78 BC, while he was watching a strangulation, the excitement became too much for him. He suffered a sudden seizure and died soon afterwards. The next 40 years were dominated by the 3 military men who, even more than Sulla before them, were to put their indelible mark on Republican Rome. They were Gnaeus Pompeius Magnus, better known to us as Pompey, Marcus Licinius Crassus, and Gaius Julius Caesar. Pompey had won victories for Sulla, to whose stepdaughter he was married, in Sicily and North Africa, for which services he had been grudgingly granted the rare privilege of a triumph. Unlike most noble Romans of his day, he had little interest in money, and politics bored him stiff. What he liked was power. He was a soldier through and through, and a highly ambitious one. Crassus, the second of the 3 giants, could hardly have been more different. Born rich, he had made himself still richer by clever, if unscrupulous, wheeling and dealing in the Roman property market. He, too, was a first-rate general when he wanted to be. But while Pompey was forever seeking means to enhance his already formidable military reputation, Crassus preferred to stay in Rome, intriguing behind the scenes for his own political and financial ends. His one major military achievement was in putting down a slave revolt, which broke out in 73 BC. Having first pursued its leader, Spartacus, through Calabria, he finally caught up with him in Apulia, where he executed him on the spot. 6,000 rebel slaves were subsequently crucified, their crosses lining the Appian Way. Pompey, who had been absent in Spain, where he founded the city of Pamplona and named it after himself, returned just in time for the crucifixions, in which he participated with enthusiasm. Characteristically, he then attempted to take the credit for the entire operation. As can be readily understood, Crassus was furious. Each had an army behind him, and for a moment it looked as if the Republic was once again to be plunged into civil war. Fortunately, the rivals came to a last-minute understanding. The two would present themselves for election to the consulship in the year 70 BC. Strictly speaking, neither of them was eligible, neither having disbanded his army as consular candidates were required to do. Pompey, moreover, who was still only 36, had not taken his seat as a senator. But the Senate had not the courage to stand up against two such men, and they were duly elected. They spent their year of office meticulously undoing all Sulla's legislation. In the years that followed, while Crassus remained busy in Rome, occupied with an interminable quarrel with the Senate over tax collections in Asia, Pompey went from strength to strength. In 67 BC, with 120,000 men and 500 ships, and in only 6 days, he virtually eliminated the pirates who had long plagued the Mediterranean, thus making the seas safe for the best part of 1,000 years. He was then dispatched to the east, where the king of Pontus was up to his old tricks. Unfortunately for Pompey, Mithridates committed suicide before battle could be joined, but there was plenty of other work to be done in eastern lands before he returned home. Without bothering to consult the Senate, he rapidly annexed Pontus. Moving south to Syria, he expelled the last Seleucid king and made this too a province, thereby acquiring for Rome the great city of Antioch. Finally, he pressed on to Judea, where he captured Jerusalem, sensibly allowing the reigning king to remain on his throne as a client of Rome. All this he accomplished in just 4 years, during which it is not too much to say that he changed the face of the Near East more radically than at any other time until the coming of Islam. When Pompey returned to Rome in 62 BC, it was as a conquering hero. He was granted a second triumph, far more splendid than the first. Many Romans trembled, remembering the return of Sulla just 20 years before, but the triumphator disbanded his troops, asking nothing but the ratification of all that had been done in the east and a grant of land on which his veteran soldiers could settle. Both requests seemed reasonable enough. With regard to the first, he had indeed acted without authority, but the slowness of communications in those days had left him no alternative. In any case, Rome's gains had been immense. The Romans had little cause to complain. Complain, however, they did. One of the principal critics of Pompey's actions was Crassus, clearly motivated by personal jealousy of his old rival. The two most powerful men in Rome were now at loggerheads, both with the government and with each other. The third and greatest member of this astonishing triumvirate now appears on the scene. In 62 BC, Gaius Julius Caesar was 38 and married to Sulla's granddaughter, Pompeia. He was to divorce her the following year. His reputation in Rome was that of a cultivated intellectual and a formidable orator in the Senate, a provider of lavish entertainments who was consequently always in debt, and a sexual profligate whose affairs with both men and women were legion, but who had nevertheless been elected Pontifex Maximus, chief of the priesthood of the Roman state. Talented, fascinating, but basically unreliable. In 60 BC, he returned from Spain, where he had been serving as governor, and where, after a few insignificant victories, he too had been promised a triumph. But now there arose a difficulty. He was determined to gain a consulship, to announce his candidature. However, he would be obliged to appear in Rome long before the triumph could be arranged, and by doing so he would forfeit his right to the ceremony. He tried to solve the problem by formally requesting that the announcement be made by proxy. When this was refused, he hesitated no longer. Plans for the triumph were put aside. He came straight to Rome. Power was more important than glory. But now there came a further blow. It had long been the custom in Rome to allocate to its prospective consuls, even before they took office, the provinces which they would be sent to govern at the end of their term.